As 1984 morphed into 1985, South Africa was in a state of anarchy.
Internally, the conflict intensifies as military might is used to reinforce police activity in suppressing uprisings in the black townships. Overall, the picture is one of escalating conflict and violence as prophetic warnings continue to go unheeded.
When people try to fight against this system, they are detained without trial, they are banned. We want to dismantle apartheid. Our people who are fighting would be ready to lay down their arms because they took up those arms for one single solitary reason: to get South Africa liberated.
The townships were ablaze as black South Africans fought with the oppressive regime demanding their political rights. And in turn, the apartheid government, under the finger-wagging P.W. Botha, cracked down with additional repressive laws and wielded a brutal police and military fist, hoping to suppress what it termed total onslaught. Bombs were going off in Wimpy bars. Shadowy government third force operatives engaged in political assassinations. There were harsh economic sanctions. The Rand tanked. South Africa became the polecat of the world. And death stalked this land. We were teetering on the abyss of total collapse and violent revolution. Something had to give. From this cauldron emerged one of the most amazing events that most thought could never happen in South Africa at that time. On Saturday, the 12th of January 1985, 120,000 plus black and white South Africans came together as a truly rainbow nation in aid of raising money for Operation Hunger. The cream of South African artists graced the stage at the world-famous Ellis Park on a swelteringly hot summer's day to boogie and party. Now, 4 decades later, we revisit the iconic concert in the park with those artists, musicians, producers, music industry, media and concert promoters to tell their stories. Music industry executive and producer Hilton Rosenthal was a driving force behind the concert and remembers how it all came together.
The inspiration behind the concert in the park began on one Saturday morning when I got into my car and heard the 7 and 2 broadcasting a telethon raising money for Operation Hunger. At the time, a phone call was made by one of the well-known artists in South Africa, challenging, donating some money, I think 50 Rand at the time from him, and challenging all other music artists to donate the same or more. The thought went through my mind, this is a wonderful thing, but how can we do something even bigger which represented the whole community and where the whole could become greater than the sum of the parts? The thought remained in the back of my mind for the next day or two. And totally by coincidence, on the Monday, I had a call from Izzy Kirsch, who was running 702, inviting me to go for a ride in a helicopter up to the new transmitter that they had just opened at the station. So we hopped in the helicopter, went up, had some lunch, looked at the transmitter, and on the way home in the helicopter while we were flying back into Johannesburg, we flew over Ellis Park, the stadium, and looking down, the thought about what had been in my mind on Saturday came back to me. And I said to Izzy, you know, congratulations on your telethon on Saturday. I thought it was a wonderful event. And I was just wondering how we could do something better or bigger. And Ellis Park would be a great place to put on a concert, but I have no idea how we should proceed. Izzy turned to me and said, you know, I know Louis Late, who runs Ellis Park, and let me have a chat with him. I think Izzy must have got back to the office and immediately called Louis and called me back the same afternoon to say, Ellis Park's in there, donated the stadium for free. It's now your job to get everything else organized. I said, thank you very much, and got to work. The decision as to which artists should appear on the concert was relatively simple. We really looked at a list of all the big artists in the country from all different genres and all different races and styles, and tried to get everyone that we could to commit to the concert. It was pretty easy for everyone to get agreement from everyone, because it seemed that at the time, everyone believed in the concept that doing the concert for Operation Hunger, and B, being able to play together on the same stage. I guess if I'd thought too carefully about doing this concert beforehand, it might never have happened, because logistically it could have been an absolute nightmare. Putting together a sound system, lighting, and security, and all the other aspects of the concert at Ellis Park, which had never really been done before for local artists on that scale. In fact, when we think back on it, the sound system was really pretty small for what we needed, but we never expected the type of crowd that we were going to get. Logistically, though, the help that I got from every single person that was involved, both in the artistic community and in the technical community, made it relatively simple.
I remember when Hilton told me about the planned concert. I have to admit, I was originally skeptical that you could put together what was ostensibly black township pop and white pop rock on the same stage. After all, the two music forms and their respective fan bases were miles apart back then. There were concerts at places like Jabalani Stadium and Happy Valley that featured predominantly black artists, and events at the likes of the Easter Rand show that were exclusively white popsters. How is this going to work? Hilton?
7 and 2 were predominantly targeted at the white audience on medium wave. There was no way that we could expect the type of crossover turnout that we did when we started planning the concert. But certainly we intended, once we put the bill together, that all artists from the different communities would be represented. And because of that, we thought that their fan base would at least support the concert. As it so happened, once things started getting into gear, everybody really came to support of the concert. The media, I remember SABC television covering it. So it became, even though 702 was primarily the station behind the concert, the promotion was much broader than that, and I think that's what contributed to the large turnout from all races and community. We could never respect it, the type of turnout that we had when we initially planned the concert. Initially, I would have been ecstatic, I think, with the attendance of around 30,000, and that was what our optimistic objectives were. Around the middle of the week on Wednesday, we had sold 8,000 tickets, on Thursday about 15,000, and by the end of the day on Friday, 26,000. So we knew that we were on target to do maybe 30 or 40,000 people. But as it turned out, I think we sold, certainly ended up selling over 100,000. Most of those obviously happened at CompuTicket on Saturday morning.
In the light of what was happening in the country and the level of mistrust and resentment between the races, there was a feeling among many that this could be a tinderbox that could erupt into anarchy at any time. I know that there were artists who were initially very reluctant to participate. Hilton Rosenthal shared his thoughts on this.
The concert happened at a very sensitive political time in the country, but we had almost no political problems or security problems whatsoever. Politically, we made sure that we had a committee that was running the concert. There was one moment that I clearly recall where I got a call from one of the security people on the side of the stadium, call for help. And I came running out to the side, and we just saw this huge crowd standing outside the gate, and people were streaming through the gates and the turnstiles with their tickets. The crowd was so large that, in fact, at one point the gate was lifted off its hinges and people just poured in. I'm not quite sure how many people came in without tickets, but you know, I think the final number was 125,000 people at the concert. We know that we sold somewhere around 100,000, so some people got a freebie at the last minute. It was amazing that the mood among the concert goers was absolutely peaceful. Head of the police force that afternoon came to me, or that evening, came and said, "It's amazing, when we have a rugby match here with 20,000 people, we have hundreds and hundreds of arrests. Today we've only had around 30 incidents, and most of them were poor people who were drunk and were just causing a bit of problems, but there'd been very little violence, and we're actually totally amazed." Everything was run by committee, and that committee represented people from all races, but mostly managers and music industry executives who helped, and everything was really sorted out before the event. I did have one moment of disappointment. In the afternoon, I walked into the office and one of the radical Sowetan journalists was looking not very happy. And I asked him what the problem was. And he said, I would rather that people were starving than you breeding fat slaves. And that was a disappointing comment that certainly reflected the political mood at the time. It just hit me though pretty hard that clearly it wasn't all just a bed of roses. We raised in excess of 450,000 rand at the time for Operation Hunger from the concert. And hopefully that went a long way to helping them establish what they were doing at the time.
There were political considerations as well. After all, Radio 702 operated from the artificially created homeland of Botswana. 702 Music Radio Managing Director Izzy Kirsch recalls the background to the station's involvement in the concert.
702, your independent station.
702 is the result of efforts that were taken by myself and my company, my brother, to establish a radio station. In the late 70s, the Republic of Botswana was proclaimed. And I realized that being declared an independent state by South Africa gave it a right to run its own casinos, which it really committed with Kirzner, to run its own television stations and also to run its own airport. And that gave the opportunity, well, of that being the case, we approached the Botswana government to open up a radio station. The frequency they assigned us, it was a medium wave frequency that had been closed down in Grahamstown. And that frequency was 702. And that is the reason why we decided to brand the station after make it memorable to listeners. And when we launched as Channel 702. I was approached by Ina Perlman of Operation Hunger some years before to start do a radiothon for Operation Hunger. We took to it straight away because we realized that this is what radio is all about. I had no fears in staging the concert at the time. In fact, I had been on many occasions been approached or phoned by the government, by the Foreign Affairs Minister about the things that we were doing. And they, for instance, they were dead against us getting involved in opening up crisis centres. They were dead against us using the radio station as a helpline. And for reasons that they weren't, and they couldn't do those things, because it wasn't within the SABC mandate. So I wasn't afraid at all, because I knew that, you know, if there was going to be any backlash because of the concert in the park, that I believe there would have been an unbelievable reaction from the South African public in general, because this was for a good cause.
Well-known radio maven and self-confessed South African music fan, Neil Johnson, was at the coalface of 702 at the time of Concert in the Park and remembers the events leading up to the day. Neil. What was your role at 702 at that?
I was on the air at that time. I was doing late nights 10 to 1 a.m.
And playing a lot of South African music.
And struggling to play a lot of South African music. There was a bit of reticence around the station about stuff being playlisted. I mean, I remember trying to get Asylum Kids on the playlist and Neil Solomon, the Uptown Rhythm Dogs. And, you know, it was quite being a young jock, you don't have much power, you know. So it was like this constant grind against the record, but against the music compilers to get that stuff on air. Well, I remember being in a program meeting when this came up, when Gary Edwards said, we're going to do this concert at Ellis Park, and there are going to be 30 bands. And, I mean, I'd never been to a concert of that size. And in the back of my head, I was going, this is massive. This is going to be massive. You know, it's logistically, just to organize a concert of that scale in that time. It was 1984, you know. And when I look at pictures and the video, the stage is rather small compared to the size of the stadium.
Petit Cheval, fronted by the Byron-esque lead singer John Selby, were the new kids on the pop block, signed to Weir Records the previous year by label manager Kim Saville. They were meant to just be a filler, really, whilst the stadium slowly filled up. Neil Johnson recalls.
So the people started coming in, and obviously the grass fills up first, you know, and then by like midday, things have moved into the first tier of Ellis Park. They put on Petit Cheval pretty early, and Jonathan just blew everyone. I mean, there must have been 6,000 or 7,000 people. But they really played as though they were playing to a packed stadium. They were really energetic.
Thank you! Thank you! Stop touching the ball! Young when we played Concert in the Park, and I was still shaping my personal worldview. I was overwhelmed by that occasion, the magnitude of the event and the huge crowd. I saw that indeed all South Africans from all nationalities and backgrounds could come together in a peaceful and joyful manner. As I look back in time, I can only imagine that the spillover effect of that concert could only have been a positive one. I think that Concert in the Park certainly played a role in the eventual transformation of South Africa and the transformation of the next generation of youth.
One of the interesting questions on the day was, how would the white pop element of the audience react to township pop and vice versa? After all, neither audience was really exposed to each other's music, as at that time, radio was segregated. Black stations played music by black artists, and the white stations played pop and rock by white musicians. And never shall the twain meet. There were some artists who crossed over, but not to the extent that we see today, where white kids listened to Tupac and Kendrick Lamar, and black kids listened to Radiohead and Metallica. And so it should be. On concert day, one artist who blew up the myth of exclusivity was a young Brenda Fassie, who showed huge crossover potential, electrifying the crowd with her show-stopping debut single, Weekend Special.
You don't have to dance. To call me on the phone.
Brenda went on to become the biggest selling female pop artist of the 80s, rivaling the likes of Madonna. Radio legend and staunch Brenda Fassie fan Alex J was one of the main MCs that day. He looks back to her crowning moment.
The artist that I really wanted to see was Brenda Fassie, because I'd been championing her on the radio station on 702. I really thought that she was going to break big. I just had this funny feeling about it. She was with the big dudes at the time. Weekend Special was the big hit of the moment. And I'd never met her. I'd played her songs on the air, so very excited. The big dudes arrived backstage at Ellis Park, and I'm off to see her. And I was very, very pleased that her and I just hit it off straight away. Nice vibe, great attitude, joking with each other. And after, you know, we'd been sort of joking to and fro the whole afternoon. And eventually went up to her, because she's now my buddy, and I put my arm around her. I said, you know what, Brenda? You and I, man, you and I would make a great, great combination. And she looked at me straight in the eye and said, Malungu, I would snap you like a twig. Brenda Fassie, ma brr.
Long before Destiny's Child, Atomic Kitten and the all-conquering Spice Girls, South Africa had the Working Girls. They were sassy, sexy, energetic and talented to boot. Performing to backing tracks, they took to the stage at Concert in the Park, wowing the early crowds with their radio-friendly songs and funky dance grooves. Justine Hertz, now Justine McFarlane, was a founder member and remembers the day that Ellis Park turned into one big multi-hued dance party.
I've played at big venues like Wembley Arena, the NSC, the SEC, BRC, all the big venues around England. And never after Concert in the Park did I actually experience what I experienced that day. Besides the massive excitement, besides the vibe, that electric freaking vibe of, it was insane. There were so many reasons behind why it was insane. It was just, there were so many people and people were so excited. There were people queuing at the doors trying to get in, and it was multicultural. So it was the first time ever that people across all these cultures, so there was this electricity in the air that was fantastic. When I walked onto that stage, we walked backstage. There were tunnels underneath going from the green room to the stage. And there was this boom. Jaluka was on. And I can't tell you, you could hardly hear yourself think. It was so loud under there from the crowd. And when I walked onto that stage, my legs went to lead. And I've never felt that before. I really battled to move. And there I had to dance and sing. I couldn't move my legs properly for the first song. I was so, the shock of seeing thousands of people looking at us, following this phenomenal band and the vibe in the place, it was, for a few moments, it was terror. And I've never, as I said, I've never felt that again at any other venue ever. That magic and that moment, beautiful, that was really amazing.
In the mid-70s, songstress Margaret Singana, lovingly called Lady Africa by her legion of fans, pioneered the way forward for black performers with a string of hit singles and albums, including I Never Loved a Man, The Way I Love You, and Mama Tembu's Wedding. Laid low by a stroke in 1980 that curtailed her live career, her surprise appearance in a wheelchair on the day was met with rapturous applause. She turned back the clock with Hamba Bakili, We Are Growing, which later in the decade became an international hit as a theme tune to the Shaka Zulu TV series.
Oh, hello! Are you happy? Are you really happy? Singana is here! Enjoy it! Yeah! Yeah, Hamba! Yo! Ayo! Ayo! Ayo!
As the day progressed, you could feel the tension dissipate. People were having a great time with no drama. Fans drank, openly smoked joints, hugged each other, and cheered on the artists, and even the police chilled out. I remember thinking, this is going to be all right. In an era when pretty boy bands, padded shoulders, massive bouffant hairstyles, and new romantic grooves were all the rage, South Africa had its own touch of musical glamour, in the form of Face to Face. By the time of Concert in the Park, the band were on a roll with sell-out concerts and a hit album, which featured their award-winning Here We Are and the top 10 hit Night of the Long Knives. Guitarist Keith McFarlane and drummer Jared Aston turned back the clock to January 12, 1985. We'll be right back. co-writer of all the band's hit material, including the award-winning Here We Are. Face-to-face guitarist and singer Keith McFarlane stepped out onto the stage at the iconic Concert in the Park, saw that crowd and thought, well, what did you think when you walked out on stage?
Let's rock. You know, I was a big fan of bands and of music and all that sort of thing. And I mean, that was just a dream come true. That was, I think a lot of the guys in the band, we actually stood on the side of the stage just to soak it up. So when we walked out, it wasn't like brand new on stage. We'd kind of been lurking in the shadows, so to speak. And it was just incredible. I mean, you couldn't really see that far back, you know. And I remember we just looked out and saw the sea of people. And I seem to remember looking at the front rows and there was all these people there. And then I remembered all the videos I'd watched of people reaching their hands down and, you know. So it all came together at once. And it was an absolute dream moment, yeah.
By the time of the concert, of course, Face to Face had already experienced all the trappings of the pop world, you know, the intense media attention, teen frenzy, sellout gigs. But I guess nothing prepared you for an audience of this size. It must have been breathtaking. Or did you see it just as another gig?
It felt normal for me at the time. This was what the industry was supposed to be about. It was supposed to be about playing in front of audiences like that in a stadium. It was about getting that recognition, getting that interaction with an audience like that. I mean, this is what we strive for as artists, is to create that kind of connection on that large scale. So at the time, for me, it felt normal. Looking back on it now, and even, you know, 20 years ago, 25 years ago, I realized the enormity of the event. I didn't at the time. And, you know, 40 years later, I realized that this was a massive, massive event that I probably regret not taking more photos or journaling and writing about it, because I've forgotten a lot of the experiences that happened on the day. And it's these kind of conversations that bring up those memories again. But yeah, you know, it felt normal. I just turned 17. You know, it was... For me, this was the greatest thing on earth, you know. And look, when we got up on stage, we didn't have the huge audience that like Clegg had and Evoid had earlier in the day, but we still played to about 35,000 or 40,000 people. I think, you know, it was probably up to 100,000 people at the peak. So it was probably the largest audience I've played to. I think it showed that South Africans can integrate without any issues. You know, I think there was definitely a fear amongst white South Africans about possibly a change. You know, we'd lived in a segregated society for so many years. Concert in the Park just showed that no one, you know, really cared about anything else but having a good time. There was no aggro there. There was no issues. There was no violence. There was just people having a good time. I think that was probably one of the big turning points for South Africans that made an easier transition to what happened 5-6 years later with the release of Mandela and the change in political the political landscape. That's kind of the legacy, and really just to be there and see the absolute love that everybody had for each other because of music, only music. People were there for the music and to enjoy it together.
If anyone can rightfully claim the title of the godfather of South African Afro-funk, then it is, without question, Sipho Hotsticks Mabuse. More than any other artist, Sipho pioneered and championed cultural exchange amongst black and white musicians. At the time of the concert, he had catapulted to solo superstardom with the release of the iconic Burnout. And on the day, Sipho performed I'm Waiting with his band, the legendary Harari.
Well, you know, musically there was this whole convergence of new styles of music, the interaction between the black and white musicians as led by Jaluka was growing in leaps and bounds, where you suddenly found there were groups like, you know, Hotline, and quite a number of groups were getting stronger. I performed mostly for many white audiences and so on, something which was really unheard of in South Africa then. And of course, there was also the rebelliousness within the music industry, where musicians felt that, well, politically, we are not going to get involved in the armed struggle, but we will use our music to make our voices heard. Well, the most exciting thing about it, when I read the Sunday Times, it was a milestone. It became a watershed for what was to happen in South Africa, because you'd never ever had the experience of black and white musicians performing on that kind of stage, where you had, 50% of the audiences being white and 50% of the audiences being black. You'd never ever experience such a huge audience, integrated audience in South Africa. I think for the first time, South Africans began to know each other through the music, and Concert in the Park was catalyst in that. Your adrenaline pumps even more when you go down stage. But when you experience an audience that you've never performed for, you have 120,000 people converged under one roof for the first time in a country where you've always known that this is not possible, your adrenaline just pumps. You say one word and you get all these 120,000 voices responding to what you said. It's just incredibly phenomenal.
I remember in the early 80s, a creative burst surged through rock in South Africa, unequaled to this day. Where the Windridge brothers of Air Void were looking at Africa with their junk jive rhythms, and Petit Cheval's John Selby was stalking the stage, channeling Lord Byron. Elemental were looking at theatre. They combined strong melodies and punchy guitar riffs with theatrical elements like creative lighting, mime, and costumes. By concert time, they were on top of their game with hits like See Yourself and Pressure, and the combination of Heather Mack's magnetic stage presence and Tim Parr's fiery guitar made them one of the highlights of the day. So what do you remember about the show?
Meeting Annalene Krill on stage. I remember when we walked out on stage that the audience, the energy coming off the audience, I just cried. There was so much love coming off the audience. And, I just cried. It was so powerful.
I just stepped into my costume. You know, I had discovered that I was pregnant. That was already in my mind at that time. And, wow, concert in the park, it felt like we were going, like we did some huge concerts in big areas before. So I didn't find myself that overwhelmed by it. I wasn't nervous at all. It was as if this moment had to happen. And more than anything, I was just so excited about the fact that it was a multiracial audience. That was the stuff that really touched me so deeply. Backstage and hanging out with people that I'd respected and knew, Steve Kekana and Brenda and all of us at the, you know, in the so-called green room, hanging out together. And I said, oh, you know, this is what I fantasized and dreamed about for all of my time since I became more aware around 16, 17, I started to become 1976. A whole lot of new stuff came into my brain, information, chilling stuff that I had been oblivious to. And so to go to that stadium and finally find myself working with my peers, and they were peers that were usually put away and put it somewhere, like just the stuff that gives me chills even talking about it. That, for me, was the profound moment of Concert in the Park.
Club and outdoor festival favorites The Rockets brought their brand of soulful pop songs and slick syncopated choreography to the festival, with a barnstorming performance featuring lead singer Ronnie Joyce that got the hot and sweaty audience even more hot and sweaty. Via Africa exploded onto a jaded and unsuspecting public in 1983, fusing dance beats, whistles, chants, new wave synths, dub bass and ethnic rhythms. Their eponymous debut album was an instant hit with pop and black radio, a rarity in those musically segregated times. Via Africa was a living force that encapsulated sex, politics, magic, music and imagination. We'll be right back.
in Africa, they know how to teach. They all laugh.
I'm sorry.
In Africa, they know how to teach. They all laugh. You blow your whistle, somebody blows that. All they get from you are fires and stairs. Your uniform is shiny at the knees. Your cheeks go red, as somebody sees. You blow your whistle. You blow your
As lead vocalist, writer and bassist René Feldman said, "We didn't make Via Africa happen. It happened to us." She mused about their explosive set at the concert.
Ah, the concert in the park. I remember the stage feeling like a detached room with a sea view of people moving like ocean waves. I remember an incredible sense of harmony, everyone together and happy. What an incredible experience. South Africans loving music and embracing each other. I will never forget that day.
Long before Marlowe was a celebrity judge on Idols, she was a successful musician with a string of hit albums and awards galore. Fusing rhythmic mbakanga and infectious Afrobeats, she tore away through a blazing set, crowned with her hit Motlele Pula, that had the crowd baying for more. One of the greatest crossover bands in South African music history was Hotline. Equally at home, headlining huge township stadiums and urban rock concerts, they were fronted by the charismatic PJ Powers and delivered a steaming set at the concert. Who can ever forget the exhilarating Jabulani and their tour de force, Dance Mama? They really got the whole stadium on their feet singing and dancing along.
People gave me the precious name, Tanaka.
I remember thinking that 702 were off their heads, and I remember thinking, this is never going to work. You must remember that I, by then, was spending every weekend in the townships. And I thought, if you're going to get you think these dudes are going to come into Ellis Park, into a place where they're not allowed to come, and come out of where they've been shoved and support, I thought, it's a pipe dream. We're going to have 10,000 people in Ellis Park. You know, I was used to playing to 60,000 people every weekend. Mm. And when I arrived at the stadium, I realized I was wrong. And I was so wrong that eventually they just opened the turnstiles and there were 100,000 people. I remember coming out of our suite and being able to look over onto the field.
Amazing.
In one of the boxes. And I just remember thinking, shit, there's a lot of people. You know, and I went into, like, I'm terribly nervous before I perform. I'm quite nervous as a human being. I shat myself. Terrifying. When Nelson Mandela was released from prison, him and I sat, and he said, music is the velvet glove that delivers your messages of pain, politics, and protest in a way that no spoken word will ever, ever do. I think what it was, and this is why it would be so glorious to reignite that candle, but I believe that in 1985, everyone in this country was absolutely sick and tired. And we, this is where the people shall govern, we wanted to change subconsciously.
Mm.
We wanted the status quo. We wanted a paradigm shift. We wanted everything to change. I think that collectively we really did. And I think that's why. When I look slowly through that concert, I just get tears in my eyes because I look at what we are. We are still that nation. We're still those people.
With multiple vernacular gold albums under his belt, the late Steve Kakana's foray into the mainstream pop world began with Raising My Family, which was a huge hit in Europe in 1980, followed by The Bushman in 1982 and his number one hit duet with BJ Powell's Feel So Strong in 1983. His impassioned performance of Raising My Family at the concert cemented his position as one of the great male vocalists of his time. There are few artists in South African contemporary music who have made such an indelible mark in our country's cultural history book. In the dark days of the early 80s, their voice, vibrant, wildly infectious jive rock fusion swept the country from coast to coast, creating a unique fan base of thousands of colorful fadgets who jettisoned white suburban values and embraced the band's vision of a united South Africa free of discrimination. Their performance at Concert in the Park is legendary, as thousands of fans can attest to. I remember looking out over a heaving, pogoing mass of people shouting, "Yeah!" on cue. Junk Jive is one of the highlights of that concert.
Just coming up midday and seeing like 100,000 people in the audience. Like, usually at a gig, you only see people, you know, in the few rows in front of you because it's nighttime. But at daytime, it's unbelievable.
I had a flat in Chelsea and I walked around Joelis Park about sort of 11. And I remember calling Lou and saying, "Oh my God, this is going to be huge." Because even at 11 in the morning, there was so many people in the ground. I thought, it was unbelievable. It's a complete one-off in terms of how you feel. We just knew, and it's one of those things that, because even my youngest says to me, "How did you know what to do and what to say?" And you just go with the moment. And the moment was so huge, even thought then, this may never happen again. And it's probably true. It hasn't actually happened the way it had then. And so it became so special. And I'm glad we seized the moment and did it.
Speak to anyone who was at Concert in the Park in 1985 and they will tell you just how electrifying Jaluka were on the day.
Scatterings and fugitives, hooded eyes and weary brows.
Johnny and Sipho plus the band brought the house down with their infectious songs and frenetic Zulu dancing. If you look at the video, the entire Ellis Park audience was on their feet for songs like Scatterlings of Africa and, of course, Impi. Watching all of this was bassist Gary Van Zyl, who was with Johnny from 1982 to 1985 and was on stage with him that day. At one of the last gigs that that lineup did before Johnny disbanded Jaluka and started Savuka.
It was an evening, and it was when I got there, I remember walking there, it was like three or four, something like that. And I thought, oh, well, here we go, another old flop concert. As you know, whenever those concerts were held those days, they weren't very good. So I walked in there, gosh, and the hair stood up in the back of my neck. I still had a bit of hair then. And it was incredible. I mean, and that wasn't even full then. By the time we got on stage, it was packed. It was pumping. It was really a night-day moment of my life I'll never forget.
Looking back 40 years later, one cannot understate both the cultural and political influence and credibility that Johnny and Sipho brought to Concert in the Park. They were the glue that held everything together, and their astounding performance on the day is indelibly imprinted on my memory. In an interview that Johnny gave some years back, he articulated the political and cultural background to the concert and voiced the hope that through music, South Africans would look into the future and see what was possible.
The event was bigger than the music because it was the first really huge non-racial, non-genre specific musical event, which came together not under a political banner, but under the banner of a cause around hunger, around poverty alleviation and hunger alleviation. It was something that we could all rally around because South Africa was so politicized. It was an issue that we could rally around, whether you were black or white, whether you came from the right or from the left, or you came from the center or from the center right or the center left. It didn't matter, because this was an issue that was kind of above politics in a way. It was about raising enough money to help people who were hungry and starving in South Africa. It stands out for me as a watershed, a cusp between the softening of the apartheid, extreme apartheid separation, the petty apartheid, the state of emergency afterwards. It's a kind of slap bang in the middle. And like all cultural events and activities, we were always looking for gaps. We were always looking at the law as artists. We were looking to where can we play legally. And we discovered, for instance, that the law said that you could not play as a multiracial band in a public venue. So we went private. So we played in churches, and we played in school halls, and we played in university halls. We did the university tours because this was a gray area. It was ridiculous because it would take the government a huge amount of time and energy to stop this. Because once it started rolling, there were so many things happening all over the place. And so culture became this area of struggle, where we were constantly, every weekend, you were pushing a boundary, finding a way to get your message across. And this together, obviously, with the highly politicized events like the struggle songs, the freedom songs that were sung at every funeral. These were events that happened, and then they would disappear. There wasn't like it was always like a kind of a guerrilla movement. Speeches were said. Funerals became a place where you could concentrate for that 5 hours. You could concentrate very powerful messages and communicate them to that region about where we are now. How do we move forward? What does the losing of this comrade mean for us? How do we behave and move forward in a stronger and more committed way? And then it would disperse. So it was a very strange time. And when I, you know, when you try to explain to people, you know, you'd have to negotiate. After the end of, about 6 months after this event, and you would have to basically negotiate in each township with street committees and the comrades whether you could put a show on, because there would, might be a funeral down the road. And if you didn't negotiate, they would come and burn down your stage and burn down your PA, and you'd run for your life. for any cultural person who had to make a living and put bread on the table, and they'd chosen that as their career, they were always put into a very difficult, paradoxical situation, because you wanted to perform, you wanted to get your music across, but then you'd be accused of playing nice time music if you were just in Mbakanga band, or you're just playing jazz, you know, without a message, because they wanted to hear a message from you about where do you live now, what do you think about what's going on, you know, what's happening, what words can you give us. So there was pressure also from the majority of people in the townships and in the cities for somewhere in your show for there to be something that you said, that you you acknowledged that there was something going on in the country that was pivotal. That was another space that artists like Juluka and Harari and all the black artists had to negotiate. White artists tended to be a bit protected from that in, that dynamic, because they were playing in white areas for white audiences. If you were working in the townships like we were, you were moving in, you know, into normal venues, but at the same time you were moving into highly politicized community township halls. You started to get a sense that there was something moving, that there was something that's now an inexorable juggernaut through the whole country. And it's moving forward. And as artists, you had to actually get into that and move with it. And so, you know, we were at shows that were stopped by comrades. People chased away during the consumer boycott in Soweto. At the same time, we were part of concerts that were stopped by the police, tear gas, army, you know. So it was like artists were in between here. We you know, if the community allowed us to perform, then the police thought, hang on. If the comrades say that these oaks can perform, we have to stop the show. They would be very happy if the comrades burnt down a show or stopped a show, because for them it showed that there was no tolerance, you know, that this was an intolerant liberation organization. And then there would be a press article, you know, the UDF or the whatever committee, you know, has shown the extremism of the liberation movement by not allowing these artists to perform and make a living, and they burnt their PA down and chased everybody out the stadium. So you had these huge debates that were going on in the cultural sphere. It was a very exciting time. It was a very chaotic time. It was a very tumultuous time. And you know, between 1985 and, you know, 1993, that's 6 years, you know, you had to renegotiate reality on a daily basis, because the boundaries were constantly changing and moving and things were happening. It was a very exciting time. And it was a time, I think, that was very inspirational for a lot of artists, because you were dealing with the daily issues, and they were all national issues. They weren't your own private issues as an artist. What do I think about it? You know, you were suddenly immersed into a much bigger picture. And so the event of Operation Hunger was actually bigger than the music, but it was the first time on such a scale that the voices of all these bands and musicians were coordinated, and they just rolled one after the other, one of them, through the day, through the night. It was fantastic. It was, in a way, a moment where you could kind of get a sense of the possibilities of things to come. It was a window to the future. It was an event, it was a 12-hour event that said, this is possible. We can be together. And not only can we be together, but you can be an Indian chap or a white chap or whatever other category you are, and you can actually dig another person's music. You may not understand the language, but you can get the groove. And people were just grooving right through. They just enjoyed the entire spectacle.
On a personal note, I remember that day as if it was yesterday, and at the time recall that I felt this was something very special. 120,000 people to see exclusively South African artists? It was unheard of and has never been duplicated again. It kick-started interest in our own culture and set the stage for many successful South African artists to come. Concert in the Park remains up there with the best global concerts, including Live Aid, which it incidentally predates. On a social and political level, although there were still many pitfalls and hard times ahead,
Concert in the Park pointed the way forward to a new democratic South Africa in 1989. It was a day that changed South Africa.
Thank you!
My thanks go out to all those who gave of their time to participate in this 40th anniversary episode, especially Hilton Rosenthal.
Hi, I'm Sipho Hotsticks Mabuse. You've been listening to another production from Solid Gold Podcasts.
Thank you very much. We'll see you later.